KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our next panelists, Fazel Hassan Abed, Margarita Gurdian Lopez, Richard Holbrook, and Ira Magaziner. And once again, our moderator, Sanjay Gupta.
All right, thank you very much, and thanks for sticking around for subsection number two, maximizing returns through increased public-private NGO coordination. We've already started our discussion we did with the panelists backstage here. I think it's going to be a very engaging discussion. Again, as before, we hope to get you engaged as well. Submit your questions. We'll get a chance to try and answer as many of those as we can. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart as well. We talk a lot about these topics on CNN, and it's interesting how interested people from all walks of life are interested specifically in the role of various sectors and what they can and cannot do when it comes to developing health infrastructure. The world has knowledge, it has medicines, it has resources, technology to dramatically improve health and save millions of lives, even in the poorest regions of the world. We've seen that, and we just talked about that to some extent. But until very recently, it has started to change very recently, but until very recently, few of those assets have actually reached those countries. Significant new funding has helped bring affordable, life-saving medications to more people than at any point before in history. And that's good news. But despite this increased funding, unacceptable and overwhelming burden still remains. How do we fix that? That's what we're going to be addressing. One reason, looking at some of the problems first, is a persistent lack of coordination. The number of actors in this play is large. There's lots of people who are involved, whether in-country and donor governments, for example, NGOs, foundations, global institutions. Trying to meet the differing donor requirements can result in sometimes very good people with the best of intentions being understaffed, being pulled away into bureaucracy. And this is where it gets a little tricky sometimes. Equally troubling, lack of coordination of purchasing of critical medicines have sometimes led to surpluses and sometimes to shortages as well. The urgency of the global health problem, as well as its crisis and response, which Ambassador Holbrook will be talking about, has sometimes had the unintended consequence of undermining local initiatives. This is really important. Sometimes even people with the best of intentions can undermine local initiatives unknowingly. And also on the flip side of that, foundation priorities may sometimes cause governments to divert resources and personnel away from efforts that must be sustained through local government. I want to get at that today. Again, we're going to be talking about not just the problems, but the solutions as well. That's why I find this so exciting. To help us do just that is our venerable group of experts. First of all, Fazel Hassan Abad, he's the founder and chair of the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee. You've already met him today. He was singled out, and congratulations for all your efforts thus far, and thanks for joining us as well. Minister Margarita Gurdian Lopez is the Minister of Health of Nicaragua. We're going to be talking a lot about Nicaragua, and specifically during her time as Minister of Health, she's improved her nation's own health infrastructure by encouraging participation of more civil servants. How'd you get that done? We'll be talking about that. Ambassador Holbrook, you all know, he is President and CEO of the Global Business Coalition, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. For those of you that don't know as much about GBC, it represents 200 international companies dedicated to fighting the AIDS pandemic by utilizing the business sector's unique skills and expertise. And of course, Ira Magaziner is the chairman of the Clinton Foundation HIV AIDS Initiative, CHAI. He's also president of SJS Incorporated, corporate strategy consulting firm of sorts. He's also a former senior advisor to President Clinton in the White House. So before we get started, please welcome our panel. We're going to be looking forward to some of your questions, but I want to go ahead and start off the discussion with you, Ambassador Holbrook. I mean, you've worked in all the sectors that I just mentioned. You've worked in the UN world, the U.S. government, the business sector. Lack of coordination is a theme that seems to emerge sometimes when we have these discussions. How do these different actors work together effectively to address global health challenges overall?
Thank you very much for asking me to join your panel. I want to talk from a narrow perspective about what I think can be done, particularly in the private-public area. This is a subject of our panel, public-private NGO coordination, problems and solutions. Well, if you identify the problem correctly, you're halfway to solving it. And let me talk specifically and narrowly about the business sector. But let me begin by saying that first we had to define the issue of HIV/AIDS and other health issues as more than local health issues. Now, there are so many health problems in the world that you had to start with something, and we started with AIDS. And in January of 2000, President Clinton, Vice President Gore, and I chaired a Security Council session, the first in history on a health issue, and declared AIDS a security issue. There are a lot of objections to that. The original charter of the UN clearly put health issues into ECOSOC. But we won that round, and today, 6 years later, people look back on that as a turning point in the battle. Once you define the issue as a social, economic, political, and even strategic issue, you began to take it out of the health field. And that's why so many of you are in the room today who aren't, and it's more than just another meeting on health. Now, that's now been expanded, of course, to include at least two other major diseases, malaria and TB. And obviously, anywhere tuberculosis is, you can be sure AIDS is rising with it or causing it to rise. Now, moving forward, governments were not enough to solve the problem. Some governments, their infrastructure was inadequate. Some, most notably South Africa, there was too much internal dispute in the government and they weren't summoning their resources. The stigma of HIV/AIDS was obviously an enormous problem. Many church groups opposed doing things about the issue for various reasons. And initially, the private sector did almost nothing. When I left the UN, Kofi Annan asked me to stay involved in AIDS because I had Wall Street and government experience. He asked me to take over a then virtually non-existent small organization, which is now the Global Business Coalition on HIV/AIDS. And we are adding malaria and tuberculosis, although we haven't formally announced it yet. In the last 2 or 3 years, there's been a remarkable growth in the perception that business has a role to play in the fight against AIDS. And our members illustrate this in many, many different ways. Our membership is very large. I brought with me to show you our membership, the logos of our members. And this is just this is not all of them, but this is about 180 of our 225 members and their logos. Many of you are in this room, and I thank you all. And we've worked very closely with the Clinton Foundation, and I will get back to that in a minute, and Ira will have his own remarks to make. Now, I want to make a generic point and then give you some specifics. If a company has people on the ground in a heavily affected area, South Africa, Botswana, India, various other countries, they can, and in my view, should undertake their own direct programs. Examples of that, Anglo-American and De Beers, Xstrata and Eskom, all in South Africa, are companies which now strongly encourage testing of workers. They don't make it mandatory for obvious reasons, but they guarantee confidentiality. And whenever testing goes up and people know their status, the prevalence of HIV/AIDS, the incident of new infections begins to drop. That kind of leadership is the most effective way to bypass governments and bureaucracies. Other companies have done remarkable things without having people on the ground. L'Oreal has done something absolutely extraordinary, which I doubt many of you in the room know about. They are training women who work in hair parlors, doing nails and things like that, none of which I must admit I know much about. They have trained the women who do your nails and do your hair in Africa and South Asia in large numbers to talk about AIDS and how to prevent AIDS with the women as they gossip under the hair dryers and have their nails done. This is an enormous, brilliant breakthrough to reach people, not through the normal euphemistic billboards and very ineffective advertising that you see all over Africa. Other companies that have done remarkable things range far and wide. Viacom and the National Basketball Association have used their networks to spread the word through their stars, sports and singers. Lafarge, Unilever, MAC Cosmetics, Merck have all done these things. They've been very heavily supported by the Gates Foundation, and, of course, there's the Clinton Foundation, which has done remarkable work. So I want to stress that even if your company is not on the ground in a heavily affected area, it has an enormous role to play if it cares. 220 companies sounds like a lot, particularly since when I started we had 17. But the fact is that there are hundreds and hundreds, thousands of companies that haven't joined. And in one particular case, and I'll be very clear about it, Japan, not one Japanese company has joined the GBC. And I'm very upset about that. And I say that publicly in the forlorn hope that we'll be able to shame somebody into it. One last point about the Global Fund. Our organization is also the official advisor to the Global Fund for the private sector. We have been collecting money for the Global Fund, working with them and with the CGI, which has also been funneling money on occasion. But I need to warn all of you that when you work with the Global Fund, it can be very effective in a general sense, but in a specific sense, it can be difficult. If you wish to work in the Cameroons or Botswana or South Africa or India, specifically, and you give your money to the Global Fund, it may not get there for a public-private partnership. In Nairobi 2.5 years ago, the head of UNAIDS, Peter Piot, the head of the Global Fund, Richard Feachum, and I announced 9 public-private partnerships in countries ranging from Cameroons to India, across Africa and South Asia. We announced 9. The money was set aside, but it had to go through the country coordinating mechanisms in each country. In every country, these projects were turned down. And they were turned down almost always because the ministries of health did not want international money to reach people that didn't go through the ministries. I'm not speaking of Nicaragua because we didn't work there, and I know that the minister has a very much more open and positive attitude towards this. But I need to warn you that even the Global Fund, and I'm a huge supporter of the Global Fund, we have an office inside their building in Geneva. We work closely with them. It has its problems. So if you're involved in a company which wants to do something, do it directly if you can. If you can't, work with the Clinton Foundation. We'll be happy to. We're not an operating foundation. They are. We'll be happy to guide you towards them. But remember, AIDS, TB, malaria, the health issues are also a responsibility of the private sector. Thank you.
All right, Ambassador Holbrook, thank you. Minister Lopez, let's keep that right up. Ambassador Holbrook took a little shot at the health ministries there, but didn't sing about Nicaragua in particular. But is that something you've seen, though? Is that true? And explain to me why that happens, if you agree with Ambassador Holbrook's remarks.
Well,
it's on.
What Ambassador Holbrook is saying, it reflects the distrust that there is in the governments and the NGOs and some of the civil society organizations. But in Nicaragua, it was the government and the Ministry of Health that said that the main recipient should be the NGOs. So we have been working very hard on having everybody receiving the funds, because we are receiving funds not only for HIV/AIDS, but malaria and tuberculosis. And we are doing fine. We were approved the second stage for it. So I would invite Ambassador Holbrook to visit Nicaragua, you know, to see how we're working. But I think that there is a mistrust at the beginning, because it has to involve funds and how you manage it and how you take into account the different dispositions or different criteria to allocate the money. But when you reach a consensus, then you can work together very well.
And Mr. Abed, I want to sort of keep up with that theme as well. You know, one of the things I was really hoping to get to in this session was talking about how you sort of overcome some of the coordination problems. Now, you run one of the largest development organizations anywhere in the world, touching tens of millions of people in Bangladesh and Afghanistan. You must have faced coordination difficulties. How do you get all these different sectors to sort of play on the same field and all work towards the same goal?
Well, before I answer your question, I'd like to start off with an anecdote. It was in 1977, I think late 79, 70, 77, 78, around that time, late 70s. The smallpox eradication was announced by WHO in Geneva, and the journalists were called and they asked the head of the smallpox program, what is the next disease to be eradicated? And he said, bad management. And bad management still characterize health delivery everywhere in the world. And let me illustrate from my own experience in trying to deliver healthcare in Bangladesh. In 1979 was the International Year of the Child, and we thought that what could we do to improve the status of child survival in our own country? And we came down to the conclusion that if we could teach one woman in every household how to make oral rehydration fluid at home, then they could rehydrate these children with diarrhea, and we could cut down infant mortality from diarrhea, which was the largest killer of children. And in 1979, what the statistics were that 135 children died in the first year of life, and 248 died before they reached their fifth birthday. So a quarter of our children died before their fifth birthday, and most of them were from diarrhea, or more than half of them were from diarrhea. And so what we went in with the program, we trained village-level women to go and teach in every household how to make oral rehydration fluid at home. So basically we wanted to transmit seven different messages: what is diarrhea, how it is caused, how it is transmitted, what's oral rehydration, how to make the solution, how to administer it, and what to do if it doesn't work, to go to the doctor and so on. So seven different messages had to be transmitted to a woman in the household. And we also wanted to ensure that she could make oral rehydration fluid correctly with salt, sugar and water properly mixed. So the first 30,000 household was done, and we sent out a group of monitors to go in and check what percentage of these women thought were actually using oral rehydration fluid at home. And we found that only 6% were using oral rehydration after being taught by our workers. So we were very unhappy about it, and obviously we wanted to find out exactly what happened, why 94% of them didn't. And we found that our workers, our oral rehydration workers themselves didn't believe in oral rehydration as an efficacious way of dealing with diarrhea. So they bought drugs in the market when they had their own diarrhea. So obviously, if the teacher didn't believe in what they're teaching, then obviously people are not convinced that therefore they don't use it. So then what happened is that we trained all our workers back. We brought them into Dhaka, showed them how exactly oral rehydration works in the body, how glucose transports saline water through the stomach wall and so on. So once they were convinced, we fielded them again. And the next 30,000 households were done, and we found that it went up to about 18-20% utilization rate for oral rehydration. So we were very unhappy about then also, because only 20% of the mothers were using it and 80% were not. What's happening? So we fielded a group of anthropologists to find out exactly what's happening in the household level. And what they came out with, they said that the answer is that you are not teaching, you are not touching the men at all, it's only women. And men are poo-pooing the idea. They are saying that, all right, these are substandard stuff. And they were not encouraging their female folk to use oral rehydration. So then we, of course, designed our program different. We designed the program so that to include men, we went to every village, we had a men's group meeting, we went to mosques, we went to marketplaces, and we talked to men. So men were included in the program, and we also then went into television and radio spots for oral rehydration, how it is made at home with home-grade ingredients and how it is administered. Then, of course, the whole program started, having a very large acceptance rate, and women started using it. So we covered 13 million households in 10 years. And basically ensured that child mortality from diarrhea was reduced dramatically. The last, when we were doing the last quarter of the country, the government came up with the program of immunization of children. In 1986, we had only 2% of Bangladeshi children were immunized. And we were brought in, we were asked to help the government to do immunization of Bangladeshi children, and we helped them in providing that. By 1990, we had 70% of the children of Bangladesh were immunized also, and the mothers knew how to make oral rehydration fluid at home. So as a result, what has happened is that Bangladesh's infant mortality rate has come down to 62 now, and it has dramatically declined. So it was a government and NGO collaboration in child survival that has worked well in rural Bangladesh in bringing down infant mortality and having an impact on child survival. We are also, right now, we are doing, Ambassador Holbrooke was saying, talking about the Global Fund. We have a Global Fund for Tuberculosis Control in Bangladesh, and government is a partner, BRAC is a partner. We are doing, we are providing identification of tuberculosis patients in the villages all over the country, and the government is providing drugs. And so that partnership seems to be working very well. And
so
we are hoping that...
of how it could work.
Yes, yeah. Yes, and it's working well.
Well, let me ask you, Ira Magaziner, when you talk about these sorts of partnerships, and I want to sort of hone in on this a bit. I mean, when you were thinking about CHAI, for example, the idea was that you have the Clinton Foundation partnering with other governments. What was the relationship, and how did you foster those relationships?
Yes, thank you. First of all, President Clinton is fond of saying that intelligence and work ethic are evenly distributed across the globe, that it's opportunity and resources and education that are not equally distributed. And the reason I say that is because the philosophy that we use in working with others is that we go in with a respect for the governments that we work with and also for the people of countries that we work with. It's their country, not ours. And in most cases, they've been elected by their people to be the leaders of these countries. And I can say that having worked in Washington for 6 years, when people talk about, corruption or this or that in the capitals of other countries, I invite them to come to Washington. We may be more sophisticated at it, but I'm not sure we're any less or more prevalent in our country than others. And I say that to say that I think we need to treat people in other countries, and donors often don't do this, with a degree of respect, and to understand that they understand their societies better than we do, and we will. And so that's the first thing that we have brought when we come. And I always tell people that we hire or our volunteers that I won't fire you for making a mistake, because we're trying to do something very hard, and inevitably we're going to make mistakes. But if you're disrespectful to our government hosts or to the people that we're working with in another country, that will be a very different story, and you'll be gone very quickly. And I must say that a lot of donors, I think, unfortunately, don't work that way. They work too often in almost a colonialist type attitude that somehow we Westerners know best, and we'll come in and fix everything. The second thing I would say is that while I support very much NGOs, both local NGOs and foreign NGOs and the good work they do, it's very important that we consider what we do in a way to be scalable and sustainable. It's not that hard to go in and carve out your own project where you do everything with some small local group of people and make it a success. And too often that's the easy path that groups will follow, because they can show success that way on a limited scale. The problem is that you can't build a whole alternate system in a country completely based upon donor finance and based upon expatriates who come in and run everything. If you want to have a maximum impact, you've got to be scalable and sustainable, which means it has to be economic. It has to be able to ultimately not rely on the donor money, and it has to work through the mainstream institutions in a country enough to be scalable to the country. The third thing I would say is that often donors operate with way too high overheads, things that the business people in this room would never tolerate. This is not lost on poor people that you work with when you are sort of living like princes and princesses in their countries with your drivers and with your fancy houses and your business class air tickets. One of the first things we did is, it costs $4,000 or $5,000 more to fly business class than to fly coach from here to Africa. I can save the lives of 20 kids for that one air ticket difference for a year. And so I say to our people, look, you can fly coach. I mean, I'll do it. You do it. You'll accumulate enough points if you want to spend your own points to go business class at some point, because that's your business, but we're not going to pay for it. Because I can, in good conscience, take that money away from treating those kids so that you can be a little more comfortable for some number of hours. The overhead levels on most aid programs are breathtaking, and they can run as high as 60 or 70%. I think there's been one study done that 60 to 70% of all USAID money never leaves the United States. It goes to U.S. consultants. It goes to U.S. overheads of various sort, rather than directly to the people that need it. So that's another point I would make. The final point I would make is the management point that's been made before. One of the things that we found to be very important is that most development projects fail for lack of good management. Often the experts, the people that are the doctors or the nurses and so on, are quite good, but the management is poor. And so what we have done is to try to marry people with management experience and people with the technical expertise together, and to try to help build capacity locally in managing programs as well as in the medical expertise or other expertise that's necessary. So I guess my message overall is that we need to stop making excuses by saying governments are corrupt, governments don't have absorptive capacity, this, that, and the other thing. My mother taught me a long time ago, the people live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. We need to get ourselves a bit more efficient and more effective and without corruption in our own governments before we start lecturing others on that. That doesn't mean to say you should tolerate bad government wherever you see it. It means, though, that you should work to improve it. And the final example I'll use of something that we don't do consciously is that a lot of NGOs and donors who go into a country will essentially hire the best people away from government or from local NGOs, double their salaries, and put them to work for themselves because they are the best people. What that does is it weakens the capacity of the government and the local NGOs, locally based NGOs, to do what they need to do. And it disrupts the whole salary structure of the country by doing it. And it doesn't help in the long run. It may help your program in the short term, but it doesn't help in the long run to build what needs to be built on the ground in the country. So what we tend to try to do is to reach to, for example, the African or Indian or Chinese diaspora and try to bring back professionals to their home countries or to hire people from the private sector to work with local NGOs or work with the local governments to try to strengthen local capacity rather than deplete local capacity. So I hope as we contemplate going forward that, funders want measurable results. They want efficient operations. They don't want money being wasted. And I think we have to hold ourselves to those standards as well as holding the people in the countries to those standards.
Great. Thank you, Ira. We have a lot more to talk about, but before we continue, I'm going to have Daniel Stone come up here to talk specifically about the rest of the afternoon, how it's going to run.
So we're getting ready to transition and asking you folks to engage with this topic. What we know is that improving coordination across governments and across institutions is essential to improving healthcare delivery. We also know that there are ways that we try to increase coordination that can have unintended negative consequences. So the question that we would like you to address for the next 25 minutes, how can we ensure that efforts to increase collaboration in the provision of health care services actually result in a positive difference and avoid creating additional problems such as added delay and other kinds of inefficiencies? You've got 25 minutes. Have a great conversation, and we'll be back up later.
All right, we are back. This is the time to actually hear some of your questions. We are trying to get real specific now in terms of discussing what works, what doesn't work, the problems and solutions when it comes to public and private coordination. It's an important discussion topic, as you've already heard. Let's get right to some of the questions. Mr. Abed, let me ask you this. Given income inequalities between the developed and developing world, is it realistic for local initiatives to be self-sustaining, or are they always going to require donor money?
That's a hard question. I think we probably need donor money for some time, but not forever. I think basically what one has to do is to try and develop local capacity, as we have been trying to do ourselves, to provide most of the basic services to our own people. We just started working in Afghanistan, and in two provinces, we have started training village-level women to basically look after 10 diseases, water and sanitation within the village, and prenatal and antenatal care for pregnant women. Just basic training. And we think that they're doing a marvelous job already. They're trying to get immunization going for all the children, so the children don't have to go to the hospital to be immunized, and we found that less than 20% are immunized anyway. So they're getting the vaccinators coming to the village, and they organize all these children so that they can receive vaccination. So what is happening is that if you can develop infrastructure, low cost infrastructure within your own society properly, you can provide basic health services to your people without really depending on for a large scale sums of money to be transferred from the West. That's what I think.
So maybe to start with, and then maybe be self-sustaining. Ambassador, let me ask you this, and I couldn't tell from your previous remarks if you really believe that collaboration is necessary or not, but let me see if we can hone down on it with this question. Should we expect private corporations to act out of social responsibility, or is it necessary to create financial incentives to motivate them? And what examples?
My answer to your question is yes. I'm not sure what you're driving at, Sanjay. Both things are necessary. Seriously, what is the question? What's the question?
Do you need to create? Can you get businesses to act out of moral obligation, or do you need to create financial incentives?
Some businesses will act out of moral leadership. Others won't. There are some great companies, many of them represented in this room, that have sought out the Clinton Foundation to make commitments at the CGI, have sought us out to join, have asked to work with us to fashion programs. There are other companies that say, this isn't our problem. We have nobody working in Africa or South Asia, we don't care. There are companies like Lehman Brothers and Citicorp, which just join, not because they... Others like Anglo-American. Anglo-American was driven to its current program, as was De Beers, and they have the two of the three or four best programs in the world for testing. Saliva testing, total confidentiality, opt-out system, which increases the people being tested from single digits to the low 90s, and obviously will help people prevent the spread of AIDS. They were driven to it by the simplest of factors. People would hide their status, and the production would decline, and it was a necessity. Now, the role of corporate social responsibility is hotly debated. I chair the corporate social responsibility of the world's largest insurance company as a member of the board, AIG. And they and the shareholders get up and say, is this really what we want you to spend? It's a terribly complicated problem. The Economist did a cover story last year arguing that corporate social responsibility was a lot of liberal junk. But I think The Economist was wrong. It's the right thing to do. Coca-Cola, the largest employer in Africa, is doing a lot. But there are other companies that say it's not our problem. I would just urge all of you in this room, the fact that you're in the room already tells me which side of this divide you're on the issue of corporate social responsibility. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. But, gosh, there are a lot of companies out there that haven't heard Bill Clinton's siren song as clearly as they ought to. They haven't seen the magic of IRA. They haven't joined the GBC. They aren't supporting the Global Fund. They aren't supporting the malaria programs. You have to prove it to them. Now, you know what the best way to do it is? To shame them into it. I have got about...
You've heard that before today, haven't
you? Look, I'll tell you a story, and here I will name a name because it's quite important. American Express. American Express, the world's largest travel company, one of the greatest companies in the world, originally joined the GBC just because we were such a pain in the ass. We just wouldn't let go, and because I used to work for a part of American Express. It's only $25,000 a year to join us. It's not very much money. And they said, okay, but we're not going to do anything. Okay, that was 4 years ago. This year, working with Bono, working with IRA and President Clinton, they joined the Red Campaign in the United Kingdom, which is 1% of all sales for people who have the Red Card, a card that's only available in Britain, will go to the Global Fund. That is fantastic. How did it happen? We pushed them very aggressively into joining. We then worked with them very intensively. John Tetstrom is our director now. His predecessor, Trevor Nielsen, a protege of Patty Stonecipher, I think I'll say, since Patty is here, worked closely with them, with Bobby Shriver, with Bono, and American Express, Motorola, Armani, the Gap, Converse, Ralph Lauren, all have these red campaigns. Any other companies in the room want to do this? Great. You can do it. It won't affect your bottom line. It'll help you marketing, but it's an individual thing. The NBA is a member. The NFL is a member. Major League Baseball isn't. You ask me why, I can't explain it to you. These things just happen. But the point I want to make is you in the room are the shock troops for spreading the word. And I don't care whether it's through the GBC or the Clinton Foundation or some other thing. We're an advocacy group. We're not an operating group. And we just try to get you to the right people. But we're just scratching the surface, and this is a very important forum to help deepen it.
Mr. Lopez, you raised your hand there. Did you want to add something to that?
Yes, I think I was Chris.
Do you have your microphone?
Sorry. I think it was Chris Jennings earlier that said good business goes with good health, you know. And when you see what happened in Asia with SARS in a few months, I mean, we have to take into account that in a ill society, you cannot make good business. And it's not a matter of leading people to their own decision. I think this global initiative has to work on that very hard, because that means that we are in a global society. What affects Nicaragua, affects Haiti, affects the United States, affects Bangladesh. So we have to work together, and that's the core of this global initiative. I think we have to do that, and people have to understand that. Why are we working so hard to prevent avian flu? Because we know that it's going to affect all the world economies, not only wherever it starts, in China or Turkey or whatever. I think we are all waiting for the avian flu to come. And if we don't work together, then the avian flu is going to come.
And Minister, you recently had a deal with an outbreak in Nicaragua. And sort of jumping off that, are there examples of when collaborations have actually resulted in increased savings, progress made ahead of schedule, innovation? Give us an example of why collaboration might be better than not collaborating.
Yes. The only way I see to confront a problem in health is working together. That's the only way. With the limitations that we have in Nicaragua or in countries like Nicaragua, that's the only way that we can work. For example, you can see the E. coli affecting through the spinach salads or leaves in the United States. According to the papers, there were 114 people affected since August 31st, one dead, and 21 states. In Nicaragua, we started an intoxication, massive intoxication with methanol, which is poison, and we had 800 people affected, 44 dead in two or three municipalities. And the only way that we could control in 13 days that intoxication was working with everybody, with the mayor, with the communities, with the religious leaders, with the army, with the police, with everybody. But in 13 days, we controlled it. So that's the way we have to do it. And I am mentioning the E. coli here because it's less people affected, one dead, and it's a longer period to be resolved. So I think that's the way we have to do it. And we have had, for example, one of the things that I would like to take advantage, let's say, of this forum is that in Nicaragua, we have illnesses from the developing world and the developed world. In the developing world, because the respiratory diseases and the diarrheal diseases are the major killers of children under five, like Mr. Abed said, in Bangladesh. And so we were questioning, what is it that we have to do to diminish the diarrhea in Nicaragua? Well, we have to wait for the sanitation and water systems. We are investing in that and with the help of everybody. But what else is happening in the world that can have an impact on that? And so you have developed vaccines against rotavirus. We don't have the money to buy it right now, but so that's what we are working on. We're working on alliances with the pharmaceutical companies to see if they could, at the beginning, donate the vaccine, and then we can put it in our budget to keep sustaining the vaccination. But that's the kind of alliances that we have to make. We have to look for the best of everybody and to give everything, because no, it's not only to get the vaccine. When you were talking about infrastructure, talking about people and talking about infrastructure as we understand it, then we put a lot of effort, we put a lot of money, we put a lot of hours and a lot of people to have that work, to have a good result.
And Ira, keeping on the theme of collaboration here, someone wanted to know about examples of cross-country collaborations. I know it's not something you do in particular, but besides just NGO-to-country collaborations, have you seen country-to-country collaborations that can maximize efficiencies, share resources, for example?
There have been some efforts that are actually very important that we're also involved in to share in real time information about what works and what doesn't work on treatment programs, for example, in HIV and AIDS and elsewhere. And there's not just the medical information, but also the organizational operational information. And with the internet, you can basically, in real time, you don't have to wait 2 years for a study to be published, you can basically set up a network, which we're now doing through an operations research activity that we're doing with Harvard and with some others, to allow for a real-time sharing of information across AIDS programs and even countries where we're not directly on the ground. We're on the ground in 26 countries, but countries like Brazil and Botswana and Thailand have agreed to participate and share data. And so what we're doing is collecting the data on a common basis so that you can know that you're actually making comparisons that are valid. And the Gates Foundation has supported us in this. And we're essentially going to be now allowing the people actually doing the care on the ground, not just at the central government level, but actually in individual provinces and individual hospitals, to have real-time access to what's working and not working elsewhere and develop models off it. So I think particularly because internet access is available because of the way the architecture of the satellites work, in the most remote parts of the world you can get internet access. You can really set these things up in a way now that allows tremendous cooperation and learning. So I think that's a very important new development that we ought to encourage more.
And a good example of that. Go ahead, Ambassador.
I just want to clarify one thing back to your very important question. Why don't some companies want to do anything in these fields, and particularly AIDS? They don't want to be identified with diseases, particularly a fatal disease, particularly a sexually transmitted disease to some extent. And where do we have our most trouble? In the travel and tourism industry, for example, which doesn't, there's some exceptions, Virgin Air, Richard Branson, United Airlines, American Express, the hotel chains. We have very few hotel chains. The one and only Kurzner International, obviously, because it's South African origins, and Accor, the French group. But they're scared to, their marketing people always say to us, we go through this over and over again, marketing people say, this isn't good for our image. Now, we have to crack through that. And that's why I said at the beginning, it's not just a health problem. And it's not just a problem, not even a crisis. In the case of AIDS and tuberculosis, it's reached the emergency levels in many parts of the world. Your one-hour show with President Clinton at CNN, which I saw, is just brilliant. But I just want to clarify to you what the issue is. It's not abstract. The marketing people put up a wall of resistance, and we have to break through it.
Ambassador, thank you very much. There have been some themes that have emerged from this discussion, and I'm going to invite Chris Jennings, who is the chair of the working group, to come up and present those.
Okay, well, another very impressive session and amazing number of insightful thoughts. Again, I'm going to go over themes that were very cross-cutting from a number of tables initially, and then the very unique nuggets that were we felt very worthy of highlighting so you could respond. So very quickly, on the first set of themes were more oriented to be realistic about what the expectation is for the business community to be responsive. They're not there to solve all problems, but they can be an effective partner. The second issue really folks to the frustration that many have felt and seen in trying to collaborate through all the reporting requirements that NGOs and others, governments and others, imposed. Thirdly was the real need to clarify roles of individual players within any coordination effort. Very important, otherwise at the outset expectations are not and hopes are not achieved. Then we got into this issue of accountability. A lot of that theme was thrown a lot. If I'm going to invest, I want to have some measurement, which may, by the way, be interesting to hear from the panel, talk about how do you ensure accountability without requiring over-reporting. The collaborations with very successful and experienced lead institutions like Gavi was raised. And also the feeling that, and very similar to some of the issues that were raised this morning, that there had to be a lot of coordination and investment at the local level. And then the last two themes worth noting, it seems to me, were that stop talking about it. Just do it. Lots of feeling about, we have lots of conferences, lots of discussions, but let's start working and doing something. And find a ways to create economies of sales amongst all the players. Okay, now I'm going to just conclude with, I think, the interesting insights and nuggets that were individually raised, but are very consistent with the underlying themes. First, setting a tight timeline leans to innovation. Have high expectations. If you have high expectations, it will be delivered. If you push hard, people will produce. Secondly, developing an actionable business plan that holds all players accountable. Don't just have a goal, say you must achieve something within certain time frames, and you'll be amazed about what people can produce. Thirdly, all players in this activity should collaborate on local salaries. There's a whole issue, and as everyone knows in this discussion, about income generation, sustainability, but if you have differential salary structures, that can undermine what your outcomes. And lastly, and this was raised by a number of people, actually not one person, I thought it was interesting, was governments need to be able to say no when NGOs or others want to come in without fear of losing funding. It was sort of an interesting insight. With that, I'll conclude and turn it back over to Sanjay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Let me get right to it, to some of these points. Mr. Abed, let me ask you, on the third slide, I believe, it says, find a way to create economies of scale and reduce duplicate NGO efforts. It seems that's something that seems to be a problem here. When you talk about coordination, there might be a lot of duplicate efforts among NGOs, maybe even in donor governments. How do you sort of reduce that duplication so that you can be more efficient?
I can think of Bangladesh is the only country, I think. There's a lot of NGOs, and a lot of us work on very similar things. Bangladesh has 17 million borrowers, microfinance borrowers. And there are three of the largest institutions in the world who are doing microfinance. Grameen Bank, BRAC, and ASHA are all working together. But what we do together is this, that among ourselves, we coordinate our activities in the sense that if you work in the same village, we sort of exchange information as to who are our clients and who are our clients who are not repaying our loans so that they don't go to us, the next MFI. So we exchange information to try and coordinate our activities. The other thing is that what we have done in cases like tuberculosis control program, where we have about 12 organizations trying to cover the entire country, we more or less worked out exactly the geographic area in which we are going to work among ourselves. So the 12 of us cover the entire country, BRAC taking up half of it, and the rest are done by other NGOs. So we have to collaborate in a way that everybody understands their role, and we more or less work out.
And clarifying some of those roles.
Yeah.
And Ira, let's keep on theme there, clarifying roles. You know, one of the most remarkable things that CHAI, the Clinton HIV AIDS Initiative, has done is to lower the cost of several of these medications. HIV medications, HIV AIDS medications. You're talking about companies that make the medications. You're talking about governments that accept the medications and local health institutions to actually implement the treatment. How do you clarify all the roles, and how did you negotiate lower drug prices bringing all those three organizations together?
Well, I think both on the drug agreements we did and also the testing agreements, we just applied principles that were well established in the business community in the 80s on total quality management partnerships, where basically it's not a question of sitting across the table and hammering the business to lower its price, but rather you collaborate to lower the total system's cost of production and distribution. And then as you lower the system's costs in a partnership, it becomes easier to lower the prices. And what we did was to help organize the buyers, the governments, to pool their volumes so we could go to the companies and say, look, there's going to be a more predictable, larger market here rather than the sporadic market that you're used to. We'll ensure that the buyers are going to pay and pay in a reasonable amount of time, which did not exist in the marketplace. And we'll also ensure that there's not corruption in the tendering and procurements so that you're not asked to raise your price to encompass a whole bunch of distributors that the government suggests that you go to. And just those simple things of having a predictable larger term volume, we went to the companies and said, we signed confidentiality agreements with them. They allowed us to come in and work our experts with their experts on production and to be able to say, okay, what would, you know, right now you're selling for a market of 70,000. If we get that market to 2 million within 5 years, let's talk about how you would scale up production using more efficient processes, larger scale processes, and so on, and project forward some cost curves and scale curves about what you would do. We went all the way back into the supply chain, back to the raw material suppliers, not just the formulators of the drugs, but the people making the active pharmaceutical ingredients and the raw materials, and did the same thing at each stage of the process, so that we could get full-scale economies at each stage, and then got the suppliers to agree to forward price for a year or two on a formula that I won't bore everybody with, that basically said you'll make it back in year three or four if we achieve the volumes. If we don't achieve the volumes, then you can raise the price again. But we knew we'd get the volumes. And so basically it was that kind of partnership of bringing the different forces together, making it a good business decision for the businesses, and kind of getting the buyers together in some way that put it together. And then we're basically extending that model now into a whole series of other areas. The other thing which I want to just reflect on, since I've got the floor and time is running out, is one of the other comments that was made, which is that on this question of setting a timeline and acting, I think this is very important. As somebody who has been a business strategist for most of his career and, you know, sent his kids to college on the money he made with it, there is too much planning in this whole arena and not enough acting. Okay, and I'm not against planning, but what we did when we first started is we said, look, we know what happens when we delay. People die. If we dive in and we start acting, we're going to make all kinds of mistakes, and Lord knows we've made our share of them. But it's better to get in there, set up a system where we learn from our mistakes quickly, and try to act rather than do all this planning and all this auditing and all these reports. And it was brought home to me because in the first experience I had in this, getting out and investigating it, I went to visit a hospital in the Bahamas where there were two kids who were dying, and the hospital was full, and the doctor said they got 3 weeks away from death probably. We managed to get drugs and treatment into that hospital quickly. 3 months later, President Clinton came down to the Bahamas, and these kids were back in school. They were giving them flowers on the stage and so on. Around the same time, I went to Rwanda and visited some clinics where we were starting up there. It took us a number of months to get going there and get the treatment started. And everybody I met in that first trip were all dead. Everybody and another generation of people had occupied those same hospital beds, all dead before we got started. So what it says to me, and I implore all of you, and I know a lot of the foundation people out here and so on, you'd like to have, you know, clear plans and clear understanding and so on. Please don't hold things up. The worst thing, the worst killer in this whole field is delay. And what we've got to do is be willing to get in there and try stuff. The metrics are not hard. You need measurements, but they're not hard. You know, how many people have I gotten high-quality treatment? That's an easy metric. Okay, it's not hard to achieve, easy to achieve, I'm sorry, but it's an easy metric. So don't force all kinds of planning on the governments or on the people trying to actually do stuff in the field. Judge them by their results and the metrics, but don't hold things up too long. People are dying out there.
Ira, thank you very much. And unfortunately, we are out of time. We hope we've given you some insight, anyways, into some of the problems and solutions of private-public partnerships. Tomorrow's Global Health Panel is going to continue with neglected health threats, including tropical and chronic. That'll start at 9:30 in the morning. Another warm round of applause for our panel, please. Thank you.